The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We're heard all over the world by progressive-minded and independent-thinking individuals. People want to look at all the information before they make a choice. And today you're going to have a chance to learn a lot. I'm going to be doing many commentaries. This is our commentary day. I will be having a guest at 12:30 today. Some of my guests is available in California. I'll be interviewing Jason Seif and about unlearning meditation. You heard me right. The obstacles beginners and advanced meditators confront when the instructions and the rules and expectations get in the way. So this is a conversation you haven't heard before, but it'll be very positive and very powerful. Then, the latest on health and healing, I'm going to be talking about the real power behind prayer. A new study shows that prayer works, and it's a major study. And then with serious issues that we're not addressing in the mainstream media, I'm going to talk about remembering the liberal hawks, those Democrats who got us into the Iraq disaster. Now they've joined the neocons to support an Iranian attack by Ali Gharib, Alternet. How junk food giant Pepsi-Cola is buying up high-ranking experts to look like a leader in health and nutrition. And by Michelle Simon, Alternet. The U.S. isn't leaving Iraq. It's rebranding the occupation. I talked about this yesterday and the day before. I said that the President and Congress and the Pentagon are being disingenuous. What they're doing is they're telling you, we're withdrawing. That's what the media will focus on. No, we're not. Those are lies. I'll explain the lies of how we are not going to reduce the actual presence and footprint in Iraq, including the 98 military bases and over 150,000 of our personnel there, including private contractors. So please tell me again, what's the war in Afghanistan about? From Anti-Empire Report, Global Research, William Bloom. I'll talk about that. And time permitting, Married to the Clinton Mob. Oh, yeah. From Robert Scheer. When I was mentioning the marriage, of course, is their business. But did anyone look into Chelsea Clinton's background, where she's working as a major hedge fund entrepreneur? Does anyone question how the hedge funds make their living? Well, I will. So as you see, we have a lot to do. And then I'm going down this afternoon to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Tonight, if you live in the Bethlehem area, watch WLVT television, PBS. I'll be premiering two brand new full-feature films on PBS television in Bethlehem, WLVT. Whenever I finish a major film, I take it to a PBS station around the country and see what's the audience response. I'll be doing what's called a double header, double pump, 7 to 10 o'clock. I'll be on and coming back late into the city, but that'll be tonight. Now let's go to the latest on health and healing. Historically, people were confused about the idea of a placebo. The placebo being that you got a sugar pill, and then you would get another pill that was supposed to be the active ingredient, whether it was a vitamin or a medication. And then you had to have a certain percentage above the drug for the drug to be considered significant. But when they finally looked at all the placebo studies versus the drug studies on tranquilizers, the tranquilizers didn't win, which meant that they're not only doing you no good, they're actually doing you harm because placebo didn't have side effects. But then the question is, how does a placebo work? And they've never been able to figure that out. Now someone thinks they've come up with an idea, and the brain's reward system helps drive placebo effect. This is from Reuters Health, and here's what it says. Want to maximize the placebo effect? A good way to do this, according to a new study, is tell someone they have a decent chance of getting the real treatment instead of a fake pill, but keep them guessing. In the study, Parkinson's disease patients given a placebo, after being told they had a 75% chance of receiving an active drug, produced significant amounts of dopamine, a chemical key to the brain's reward system that is scarce in the brains of patients with Parkinson's. But no dopamine response occurred in patients given placebo after being told they had a 25% chance, a 50% chance, all right, or 100% chance of getting the real treatment. The findings show that expectations directly regulate the power of the placebo effect by kicking the brain's reward system into gear, probably not just in Parkinson's patients, but in a number of different illnesses, such as chronic pain, depression. And that's according to Dr. Stosel of the Pacific Parkinson Research Center in Vancouver. Quote, the greatest form of reward is really to get better, so expectations of improvement is akin to expectation of reward, unquote. Now, I'll give you my take on this because I deal with this all the time. Just give you an example. Last evening, I see most of the people that I counsel at night or talk to them over the phone or go to the hospital wherever they're at. And virtually 99% of these people are terminal. And they've been told there's nothing more can be done. And they're generally told this, you've got 6 months to live maximum a year. But if you want to try an experimental chemotherapy, and when they do, they generally go downhill quickly. And the first thing they ask is there any chance? And the very first thing I tell them is, absolutely. And then I ask them a question. How healthy do you want to be from this point forward? And there's always this pause because they don't know what I'm asking. I said, what do you mean? Well, if you could be as healthy as you choose to be, how healthy would that be? A little bit of improvement, maybe keep the cancer in your lung and pancreas, but get rid of some of the spots in your bone. Or get rid of all of it, or part of it, some of it. And what's interesting is how few people ever, ever, in any aspect of life say, I want to be as healthy as I can be. I could say in the last 20 years I've maybe had 5 people tell me that. And yet, it's when they start to believe that they can be very healthy, the entire immune system, they liberate the inner healing energy, and all other possibilities are enhanced because they have a new expectation. And their expectation of getting well and overcoming the cancer or overcoming the heart disease or overcoming the AIDS or whatever it might be, that expectation is impacting their brain. It's impacting dopamine. It is helping the brain with its reward center. My reward is if I really try, I'm going to do better. It doesn't mean everyone will survive. It doesn't mean everybody will get better. But considering that nobody would get better without that effort, and the fact that you can have 50, 60, 70% of people improve or completely reverse their disease is unheard of. But the key is, it's not just about protocol. It's about attitude. I'll give you an example. There was a young boy with cancer, and the original therapy didn't work, the orthodox therapy. Cancer got worse, and then the mother heard about alternative therapies and wanted to try some alternative therapies. And the boy was actually succeeding on the alternative therapy. But then when the doctor, who was the original doctor, who was no longer treating, got wind of it, turned it over to the Child Custody Services and Family Services, and then they were visited. Aren't you using the Orthodox therapy? I did, but I'm not now. It didn't work. This new one's working. Then they took her into court and threatened taking her child away. Very stressful for the kid to be separated at a young age from his mom. Mind you, even though the child was benefiting from the alternative therapy and had not benefited from the original Orthodox therapy. And so finally, the court said that the child could get the alternative therapy. The mother then went down to the Bahamas to Dr. Lawrence Burton's clinic. Well, I was down there helping with Burton's clinic staying open, because there was a lot of pressure from the United States to close it, including, I won't tell this story today, but at some point I will either write or tell the story of the bag man with the cash, the prime minister, and closing a clinic. Remind me at some point to tell you that story. In any case, and how I interceded in that process. In any case, I scared my lawyer to death. I mean, scared him to death, because he made the mistake of coming with me. And he didn't know how confrontational I am when it comes to these things. Anyhow, I won't get into it now. But here was this young boy, and on a really strict program. And there's no other kids around. And I suggested, what would you like? He said, oh, I can't have it. And I said, what? He said, ice cream. So managed to get this kid an ice cream with as many balls of ice cream you could stack on it as humanly possible, until they started to drip and melt and fall over. This kid had a smile from ear to ear. He just couldn't be happier watching him lick up all that ice cream. But no one knew about it, right? The kid's immune system took a big bounce up. And they thought it was the therapy. Well, it could have been the therapy, but it could have been something else. It could have been the fact that now this kid had some joy and happiness, had a reward, and had a greater expectation. And the power of reward, the power of positive expectation, is crucial to the healing process. And that's why you can't have negative people around you. If you are sick, you've got to separate yourself from toxic people, toxic relationships, because there's no greater risk than someone else's negative energy becoming your energy and that energy taking you down. So it's very important to surround yourself with loving, positive people, and always with greater expectations. All the things you're going to do when you finally get your health back that you haven't done up to this point. Place you're going to go and food you're going to eat. It's like the New York City Marathon. You start off the marathon on the Verrazano Bridge. Everybody's laughing and cheering and happy and up. And you get to the top of that first mile, which is straight up. And you're not even aware you've been running straight up for a mile, because you've got so much adrenaline pumping. You're caught up in the mass of positive energy. And you come down, and then about the 10-mile mark, you get into your stride and you realize you're really in a race. By the 20-mile mark, you're hoping to finish the race. You don't hear the cheering anymore. You see these heads down and people trudging away. So you start to think about all the things you're going to eat. I mean, you think, I'm going to have a whole watermelon. I'm just going to bury my face in the watermelon. I'm going to have the largest salad in history. I'm going to have... And then you start imagining all these things. And next thing you know, you've gone 3 miles. All the while, and ask anybody who runs these marathons, because there's such glucose deprivation at that point. You have no glucose. You have no energy. So you're thinking about food. And not that you can eat after a marathon. If you did, you'd throw up, because your digestion doesn't return for about 8 hours. But it's the expectation. And that just lets you take another step. So that's one of the reasons that placebo works. And it's one of the reasons that positive thoughts work and positive reinforcement. And it's one of the reasons that when you're out there racing, and I do a lot of racing, generally 15 championships a year. This year I did 15 championships and won 15 championships. When you're doing these local state championships, you're lucky if you get 2 spectators. But when you do, and you hear someone call out your name, and and, you know, cheer you on, suddenly you feel that little pickup. Your whole body responds. Just imagine a whole field, a whole, you know, think of a football game. And the athletes work with that energy in a good way. And it's a part of that whole reward and expectation. The audience is expecting you to do well. You're expecting yourself to do well, and you take the energy. So just remember, positive energy, positive thoughts, positive people equals positive outcome. Next up, the modern Western diet leads to allergies in children. And this is a major study, and it says a team of researchers from Florence University in Italy have found that the modern Western diet of high sugar, low fiber, processed foods is contributing to allergies and other problems not seen in those who eat more primitive diets. And we know that. And we have inflammatory autoimmune disorders, obesity and allergies and eczema, and they don't. So, and they also have more good bacteria in their gut, and we don't. For those of you who've been taking the cholesterol drug, it's Zocor, the FDA warns that it can cause fatal kidney damage. That's right, fatal kidney damage. 11 cases of that damage reported, and at 80 milligrams. So my suggestion is you don't need drugs to lower cholesterol. Diet will do it very nicely. And finally, your state of mind affects your ability to heal. A new study published in Diabetologia has found that one's mental state of mind affects his or her ability to heal from an illness. People with diabetes who develop foot ulcers, for example, can stall proper healing of their condition because they become upset and depressed. The study evaluated diabetes patients on all levels of the depression spectrum, and most are depressed, and found that those with the worst depression were the least likely to heal quickly from foot ulcers. And it's all about mind. So you've got, once again, to have the right mindset, and as long as you've got the right mindset, it can make an enormous difference. I mentioned at the beginning I talk about this healing, so I'll add this in. From the Southern Medical Journal, a peer-reviewed journal, reports of a finding on an international study on healing through prayer suggests that prayer from another person's healing just might help, especially if that one praying is physically near the person being prayed for. And they found a substantial benefit, and they actually measured groups of people who had hearing loss and vision loss. Why? Because those are two things you can actually objectively measure. Vision went from 2400 before prayer to 2080 and better after prayer. And before, the subjects with impaired hearing reduced the threshold at which they could detect sound by 50 decibels. That's an enormous change. So these were hard objective data, and that's good. So now here's what it means, though. It means that if you have people near you who are praying, and you're aware that they're praying for you, the power of their prayers, if you know they're praying for you, is more powerful than if you don't know people are praying for you. So that also brings in that whole idea of the projection expectations. But it worked. And from the environmental section, if you live down in, well, anywhere where there's a beach, this was South Beach, a team of researchers from the University of Miami examined the risks of illness that beachgoers face when exposed to recreational marine water at subtropical beaches with no known source of pollution or contamination, meaning clean beaches, clean water. 1,300 volunteers, all local residents who regularly use South Florida beaches. And what they did is they had these people go in the water for just 15 minutes. And during that 15 minute, they had to go underwater for a few seconds three times. And then they studied their health. Well, gee whiz, guess what they found? Now, mind you, this is clean, beautiful beaches. All right? They found that you were 176% more likely to develop a gastrointestinal illness, 446% more likely to report having a fever or respiratory illness. And swimmers in the study were at also 600% more likely to report a skin illness than those who stayed out of the water. So, clean water? Healthy water? No. No, that's our perception. That's the myth. The study shows all kinds of microorganisms in that water you didn't know existed, and they cause illness. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you to this program. I'm Gary Nall. For those of you living in the Bethlehem area, tonight I'm going to have two specials on the PBS station WLVT. Hope you can watch it from 7 to 10. Next Wednesday, the 11th, I'll be in Sedona, Arizona. For those of you out there, I'll be doing a lecture. All my other lectures are full, so I don't mention them because I don't want people to be disappointed and come and can't get in. But for the next 6 months, all my travels all around the world, every lecture, packed. So I won't mention them. And my guest will be here in about 12 minutes, Jason Seif, to talk about unlearning meditation. I think that'll be interesting. And a lot of good stuff is happening at the Progressive Radio Network. We're working now on setting aside one entire day, probably Saturday or Sunday, just to do literary discussions where the great authors in all genres of writing will be interviewed by the most formidable minds in literature. So you will have one place where thinking people who want to know in depth about the topic, the author, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, will have a chance to do that uninterrupted. So, again, we're trying to always lead in providing you with the best of broadcasting, and that'll happen very soon. We're also building a state-of-the-art new studio where we'll have sets and people from all over the world will be tuning in, and we'll have video, etc. It'll be in about three months. Also, we could use some drivers who have vans to transport some product from our manufacturer, new manufacturer, to our warehouse. As soon as it gets there, then I can start mentioning it. If you have a van, take a couple hours, give a call to Kara Lee. Kara Lee, could you give them your number, please?
Oh, yeah, you can get a hold of me at 646-926-5428. Again, that phone number is 646-926-5428.
Thanks. Now, a couple commentaries, short commentaries, and then I'll open it up for your thoughts on this. First, from Seamus Milne of Common Dreams, short, the U.S. is not leaving Iraq. It's rebranding the occupation. Obama says withdrawal is on schedule, but renaming or outsourcing combat troops won't give Iraq back their country. For most people in Britain and the United States, Iraq is already history. Afghanistan has long since taken the lion's share of the media attention as the death toll of NATO troops rises. Controversy about Iraq is now almost entirely focused on the original decision to invade. What's happening today barely registers. That will have been reinforced by Barack Obama's declaration this week that U.S. combat troops are to be withdrawn from Iraq at the end of the month, quote, as promised and on schedule. Well, for much of the British and American press, this was the real story. headlines hailing the end of the war and U.S. Troops to leave Iraq. Nothing could be further from the truth. The U.S. is not withdrawing from Iraq at all. It's merely rebranding the occupation, just as George Bush's War on Terror was retitled Overseas Contingency Operations. When Obama became president, U.S. combat operations will be relabeled from next month as Stability Operations. But as Major General Stefan Lanza, U.S. military spokesman in Iraq, told the New York Times, quote, in practical terms, nothing will change. After this month's withdrawal, there will still be 50,000 U.S. troops and 94 military bases, quote, advising and training the Iraqi army, providing security, and carrying out counterterrorism missions. In U.S. military speak, that covers pretty well everything they might want to do. So, what Obama once called the dumb war goes remorselessly on. In fact, violence has been increasing as the Iraq political factions remain deadlocked for the fifth month in a row in the Green Zone. More civilians are being killed in Iraq than Afghanistan, 535 last month alone, according to the Iraqi government, the worst figure in 2 years. And even though U.S. troops are rarely seen on the streets, they are still dying at a rate of 6 per month. Their base is regularly shelled by resistance groups, while Iraqi troops and U.S.-backed militias are being killed in far greater numbers. And Al-Qaeda, Bush's gift to Iraq, is back in business across swaths of the country. Although hardly noticed, it's there. Meanwhile, the U.S. government isn't just rebranding the occupation, it's privatizing it. There are 100,000 private contractors working for the occupying forces. So we will have 150,000 people in Iraq, U.S. people, 94 military bases, the largest embassy in the world. And why? Simple. Here's what you're not told. This war has always been about oil. Now that the United States has the power to provoke concessions from the Iraqi government to keep them in power, major U.S. multinational corporations have gotten 30-year contracts to do the oil out of Iraq. That means that oil can be pumped in greater quantities than before. That means then that will challenge OPEC's control over the price of oil, which means then it can be used as a political tool saying, see, we got cheaper oil, therefore cheaper gasoline. It's always been about oil. Finally, remembering the liberal Democratic hawks who got us into the Iraq disaster, now they've joined the neocons to support an Iranian attack. This was originally from Loblog. Despite some questionable choices of scholars like neocon Elliot Abrams and Max Boot, the Council on Foreign Relations is an enduring institution in Washington foreign policy circles. New York and Washington-based think tank has long been seen as representing mainstream established dialogue matters of U.S. relations with the rest of the world. But the close contact and cross-pollination of ideas between the Council on Foreign Relations and the powers that be is troubling in light of the Council on Foreign Relations' increasingly hawkish direction, especially on Iran. Just like during the run-up to the Iraq War, liberals and realists on the Council seem to be abandoning their traditional allies and siding up to the neocons and the ultra-conservatives in their view of the U.S.'s fraught relationship with the Islamic Republic. And just like the run-up to Iraq, they're getting their opinions uncritically published in the mainstream outlets that are widely read in Washington. This week, we have yet another pair of ostensible liberals, Ray Takiyeh and former Clinton National Security Advisor Steve Simon, using rather alarmist language to ask if President Barack Obama would strike Iran if faced with as yet hypothetical scenario of Iran getting close to acquiring nuclear weapons. In the Sunday opinion section of the Washington Post, they list some of the top factors the administration would need to consider should it choose to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities, including international outrage, domestic public support, cooperation of Arab Gulf states, the likely staging grounds would also need protection after the bombing run, and whether to warn Iran and make sure a confrontation does not escalate out of control. Well, the last point is particularly laughable. Analyst Tony Karan, who on his blog derided the piece's How to Bomb Iran manual, called an attempt of an aggressor to control the level of a hot conflict amid tense relations quite simply bizarre. Quote, "Of course Iran is going to retaliate painfully over years, even decades. Bombing will, as sober heads have warned, almost certainly spark a protracted war with potentially devastating consequences for Iran, its government and people, including its opposition, Israel, the United States, which has hundreds of thousands of troops stationed in Iran's immediate neighborhood and the wider Middle East, and it's more likely to make Iran acquire nuclear weapons than to deter it from doing so." So now what you have is you have the so-called liberals or so-called progressives on the Council on Foreign Relations being the ones who are banging the drums for war with Iran. And that, friends, is an enormous mistake that we should not ever contemplate. And finally, and I will continue to share these commentaries because I feel they're important, because they're not in the mainstream or even the liberal media. When facts are inconvenient, when international law and human rights and history get in the way, when war crimes can't easily be justified or explained away, when logic doesn't help much, the current crop of American political leaders turns to what is now the old reliable 9/11. We have to fight in Afghanistan because somehow it's tied into what happened on September 11, 2001. Here's Vice President Joe Biden. Quote, "We know that it was from the space that joins Afghanistan and Pakistan that the attacks of 9/11 occurred." Here's Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina. "This is the place we were attacked from, 9/11, Afghanistan." Representative Mike Pence, the third-ranking House Republican, asserted that the revelations in the WikiLeaks documents did not change his view of the Afghan conflict, nor does he expect a shift in public opinion. Back home in Indiana, people still remember where the attacks of 9/11 came from. Duh. They didn't come from Afghanistan. My God, have we completely gone illiterate? Here's what President Obama said a year ago. Quote, "But we must never forget that this is not a war of choice. This is a war of necessity. Those who attacked America on 9/11 are plotting to do so again. If left unchecked, the Taliban insurgency will mean an even larger safe haven from which Al-Qaeda would plot to kill more Americans." And here is the president 2 days after the release of the WikiLeaks documents referring to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Quote, "The region from which the 9/11 attacks were waged and other attacks against the United States and our friends and allies were planned." Never mind that out of the tens of thousands of people the United States and its NATO front have killed in Afghanistan, not one has been identified as having anything to do with the events of 9/11. Not one. Never mind that the plot to kill Americans in 2001 was devised in Germany, Saudi Arabia, Spain, and the United States more than in Afghanistan. Why hasn't Washington bombed Germany, Spain, and the United States? You're going to bomb where the terrorists are, you've got to start bombing here. Indeed, what actually is needed to plot to buy airline tickets and take flying lessons in the United States? A room with some chairs? What does an even larger safe haven mean? A larger room with more chairs? Perhaps a blackboard. Terrorists intent on attacking the United States can meet anywhere they want in the world, with Afghanistan probably the last place that they would meet. There are many people in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the ones still living, who we haven't killed yet, who deeply resent the United States present there and the drones that fly overhead and drop bombs on their houses, their wedding parties, their funerals, their life. As in Iraq, the American war on terrorism in Afghanistan regularly, routinely, and conspicuously creates numerous new anti-American terrorists. The only war of necessity that draws the United States to Afghanistan is the need for protracted efforts to protect the oil and gas pipelines in the Caspian Sea area. The establishment of military bases in this country that is surrounded by the oil-rich Caspian Sea and Persian Gulf regions and making it easier to watch and pressure next-door Iran. What more could any respectable imperialist nation desire? Oh, did I mention that the military-industrial security intelligence complex and its shareholders will be further enriched? But the war against the Taliban can't be won. Except perhaps, how about this? Why don't you just kill every person in Afghanistan? I'll bet Dick Cheney right now says, did he see that? I agree with that. That's what we should do. Kill them all. Let God figure it out. That was a statement from the Crusades. The United States should negotiate the pipelines with the Taliban, as the Clinton administration tried to do without success, then get out and declare victory. Barack Obama can surely deliver a very eloquent victory speech, you know, like the one that he delivered when he took up his Nobel Peace Prize. What part of the piece of that prize was completely contradictory? If and when the United States and Israel bomb Iran, marking the sixth country so blessed by Barack Obama, and the sad old world has a new daily horror show to look at on the television sets, and we then discover that Iran was not actually building nuclear weapons at all, the American mainstream media and the benighted American mind will ask, why didn't they tell us that? Did they want us to bomb them? Well, the same questions were asked about Iraq, following the discovery that Saddam Hussein didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. However, in actuality, before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, officials had stated clearly and repeatedly on multiple occasions there were no weapons. I'm reminded of this by the recent news report about Hans Blix, former chief United Nations weapons inspector who led a doomed hunt for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Last week he told the British Inquiry into the March 3rd invasion that those who were 100% certain there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq turned out to have, quote, less than 0% knowledge of where the purported hidden caches might be. He testified that he had warned British Prime Minister Tony Blair in February 2003 as well as Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in separate talks that Hussein might have no weapons of mass destruction. In August 2002, Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz told American newscaster Dan Rather on CBS, we do not possess any nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons. In December, Aziz stated to Ted Kopp on ABC, the fact is we don't have weapons of mass destruction. We don't have chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons. Hussein himself told Rather in February 2003, these missiles have been destroyed. There are no missiles that are contrary to the prescription of the United Nations in Iraq. They are no longer there. Moreover, General Hussein Kamel, former head of Iraq's secret weapons program and a son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, told the UN in 1995 that Iraq had destroyed its banned missiles and chemical biological weapons soon after the Persian Gulf War. There are yet other examples of Iraq officials telling the world that weapons of mass destruction were non-existent. So if you don't already have serious doubts about the mainstream media's devotion to questioning the premise and rationales underlying America's foreign policy, consider this. Despite the two revelations on Dan Rather's CBS network programs and the other revelations that I just mentioned, in January 2008 we find CBS reporter Scott Pelley interviewing FBI agent George Pyro, who had interviewed Saddam Hussein before he was executed. Pelley, and what did he tell you about how his weapons of mass destruction had been destroyed? Pyro, he told me that most of the weapons of mass destruction had been destroyed by the UN inspectors in the 1990s, and those that hadn't been destroyed by the inspectors were unilaterally destroyed by Iraq. Pelley, he ordered them destroyed? Pyro, yes. Pelley, so why keep the secret? Why put your nation at risk? Why put your own life at risk to maintain the charade? Well, would it have mattered if the Bush administration had fully believed Iraq when it said it had no weapons of mass destruction? No. There was ample evidence that Bush knew this to be the case, as did Tony Blair. Saddam Hussein did not sufficiently appreciate just how sociopathic, in fact psychopathic, his two adversaries were. Bush was determined to vanquish Iraq for the sake of Israel, for control of oil, and for expanding the empire. Though it hasn't all worked out as the empire expected, for some odd reason. It seems that the Iraq people resented being bombed, invaded, occupied, and tortured. The result of Bush's Iraq policy can be summed up by saying that it would be difficult to cite many other historical examples of one nation destroying another nation so completely, crushing, perverting virtually every aspect of their society and humanity. Now, Israel presses Washington relentlessly to do the same thing to Iran. Not that the U.S. necessarily needs much prodding, primarily because Israel is determined to remain the only nuclear power in the Middle East. This despite Iran's telling the United States and the world many times that it is not building nuclear weapons. But if Iran is in fact building nuclear weapons, we have to ask, is there some international law that says that the U.S., U.K., Russia, China, Israel, France, Pakistan, and India are entitled to nuclear weapons, but Iran is not? If the United States had known that the Japanese had deliverable atomic bombs, would Hiroshima and Nagasaki have been destroyed? Does Israel and the U.S. believe that there are not enough horror and suffering in the world as it is? I'm Gary Knoll. Commentaries are ended for today. Now, we're going to go to our guest in just a second. I'm being told that he is online. And before we go over to my guest, Kara Lee, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, I just wanted to come in briefly and kind of promote some of the new shows that are going to be joining us on PRN. We've got some great new guests and hosts that are going to be taking over some of our weekend programming. Starting off with this Sunday, Dr. Helen Caldicott is going to be having her own show Sundays at 3 p.m. called If You Love This Planet, featuring in-depth discussions about different problems our planet is facing and different ways to solve them. We also have a new show with Maria Heller going to be going on Saturdays at 7 p.m. Maria has been doing broadcasting for the past 12 years and has great guests on her show like Jesse Ventura, and Dr. Andrew Wakefield was on recently as well. And last but not least, Taking Aim is going to be joining us Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. with Maya Schoen and Ralph Schulman from WBAI.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate you bringing us up to date.
Thanks so
Helen
much, Gary.
Helen Caldicott is a real champion. So we look forward to her joining Progressive Radio Network. Now, let's go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by, Jason. By the way, I don't want to mispronounce it. Is it Sif or Sif?
Sif.
Sif. Jason was a Buddhist monk in Sri Lanka during the 1980s. And after his return to the U.S., he pursued a career in psychological counseling and founded the Skillful Meditation Project in Southern California to further investigate the phenomena of meditation practice and the pros and cons of traditional meditation practice for Westerners and postmodern society. And in addition to publishing articles in a variety of Buddhist and spiritual magazines, he is the author of a recent book, Unlearning Meditation, What to Do When the Instructions Get in the Way. Now, there's not been much novel or good coming out in the spiritual community in a long time, in my opinion. I read all the books, but I find that your book is unique and very valuable since it addresses some issues I'm sure many meditators, beginners and advanced, confront frequently. And I'm going to get into that in a moment. Among our listeners are people who regularly practice some form of meditation. Many probably practiced at one time, but gave it up for whatever reasons. Others may just be starting, and still others are probably new to it and have an interest in learning how to meditate. So I would like, if you would please, to focus on the different elements that we must consider at the early stages of either contemplating learning to meditate, are just beginning, and some who may be struggling with it. And as someone who has been advocating a vegetarian lifestyle for decades, I see over and over again where adopting a vegetarian diet for many is either a fad or more or less a hobby instead of being an actual philosophy and lifestyle that is integrated into our overall lives. And I'm sure that, well, I won't be sure, I'll ask you if you agree that this holds true for meditation, that it should not be something separate from ourselves, but become part of us, as it were. So I would like you to begin by first addressing the difference between meditation as a neat hobby to do for mundane reasons, and meditation as a part of our total life and as a means to accept life's constant changes and move joyfully and calmly through these changes. And by the way, I forgot to mention earlier in the show, you can watch today's show online at Progressive Radio Network. Would you address these, please?
Okay. it's to give it a bit of thought. It was actually easier for me to focus on your initial question around people beginning a meditation practice and those who've been meditating for a while. So let me address that first, and then I think I'll be able to go into the area you're asking me.
Okay.
When people begin a meditation practice, they're often given a set of instructions to do, and the meditation practice is often then driven by how well one does instructions. So if one gets instruction to be aware of the breath, one may be very concerned about always bringing one's attention back to the breath, how well one is doing it, what should be gotten from that practice. If one feels, you know, if you feel your mind has wandered a lot, you might feel that you're not getting it or you're failing. And that's really because it's being presented and taken in as instruction centered, and that meditation really is something about our minds and learning about our minds. And so the way I tend to teach is for people to allow the thoughts, feelings, sensations, whatever is coming into your experiences in meditation to be there and to follow where your mind goes rather than trying to follow instructions. And that produces a kind of openness and receptivity to your experience. It may also feel a bit out of control. So what I suggest to people along those lines is just very occasionally coming back to awareness of the body sitting or sounds or whatever object seems to center you. And but only stay a little while and allow thoughts and feelings to you know, come back, or for you to go into those things again in the sitting. And then you might find that your relationship to your thoughts and feelings are much different when you meditate, that instead of trying to stop them or avoid things or manage your experience, you're actually able to be gentler and kinder with your experience and go along with it. And for many people beginning meditation, this is actually a very easy way to go into it. It's something where you may find that just sitting in a comfortable posture and, say, being aware of the touch of your hands on your legs, or just the way you're sitting, and allowing thoughts and feelings into your sitting may actually produce a certain kind of ease and tranquility at the beginning of a practice. Now, when it comes to my perspective on how meditation may actually fit into our regular life outside of meditation is essentially if you allow your world outside of meditation into your sittings, you know, you allow your thoughts of work, of plans you have, of things happening in your relationships to come up while you're meditating, when you go back into those situations, you may find that you're approaching them a bit differently because you've actually sat with it in a kind of different mental environment, in an environment where you're still, or your posture is still, you're not going to necessarily talk to people while you're meditating, you know, or send an email or something. You'll find that instead you'll sit with that conversation and let it go through in a more meditative process.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. The use of the term unlearning, as you apply it to unlearning meditation, reminds me of it being used similarly by one of the first Sufi teachers, one of the first to visit the West in the early part of the 1900s, Inalayat Khan. But in the context of all the data and information knowledge we have accumulated and grasped, he said something. He said the first thing that is necessary is the mastery of mind. And this is done by unlearning all that one has learned. The inner knowledge is not gained by adding to the knowledge one has already achieved in life, but it requires a solid foundation. And one cannot build a house of rocks on a foundation of sand. And that, to me, was a powerful statement. In order to make the foundation on rocks, one has to dig into the sand and build the foundation on the rocks below it. How does that compare to what you're speaking about when you refer to our need to unlearn meditation, particularly the kinds of rules and instructions that we're given in the context of a society that, if you look at the media today, if you look at the major institutions, even today in the paper, it said that that one school in New York City that had given a lot of attention and money and focus had only 2% of the students in the 8th grade be able to pass a test at the lowest number you could pass a test at. 90% failed. And that means the average American, the average person in our society, is choosing to build their life upon the illusion of their story, is what I call it. Like building a foundation on sand. You know, we don't want to dig deep. We don't want to know too much truth. The truth of the media would scare them. The truth of institutions would show they have betrayed us. The politicians, it would show that they are not working for us. So virtually everyone is building everything on sand today, and I don't see that this being any different when it comes to meditation. Your thoughts, please.
Well, that's a very interesting observation. The way I look at unlearning meditation is more, you know, from a practical point, as many people learn techniques how to meditate, and that the techniques become very rigid for that individual. And what I really suggest is that instead of trying to learn a new technique, which is often just carrying over that same rigidity and some of the same self-criticism and things that are part of the old technique, is to look into how you are using a technique. How are you actually holding that practice? And to do that, I really feel people need to loosen their hold on their meditation practice, to feel they have permission when they sit not to do the particular practice that they've been doing all the time, but rather to also sit with whatever comes up, or try something else, or that they have choices within their sittings to do other things. So the unlearning process, I think, is one of experimentation and getting more in touch with what it is you're experiencing, while also looking at what you've done before, and not just throwing that out, not just throwing out a practice you've done for years, rather seeing the benefits that have gone on in that practice, and that you can have those benefits without being harsh or hard or, you know, too pressured around the way you meditate. For example, you could find your attention just coming back to the breath quite naturally while you sit and meditate, and then try to hold that for a while instead of starting a meditation sitting by getting down to work and just being where your breath and trying to maintain that all the way through the meditation.
Oh, okay. Well, that's very reasonable. Explain to us the symptom you call meditator's guilt, and how does that setting too high a standards for ourselves get in the way of really benefiting from meditation?
Yes. When talking about meditator's guilt, what I encountered were that people would often, when asked about their meditation practice, would just respond that, "I don't sit often enough, I don't sit long enough, I'm not a very good meditator." And so they would tend to respond with an assessment of their meditation sitting instead of talking about what it is they knew, what they experienced while they sat. And I saw that this was a great loss, that there's such richness in us when we notice our experience in meditation, and why wouldn't we put our attention there? And so it seemed to me then that part of meditation, well, part of what meditators feel around the guilt is that there's a particular promise that is being given to them, or that they've believed in going into meditation, and that they're not necessarily receiving that promise. And some of those promises are very idealistic. I mean, to have an empty mind, to be always tranquil, to see their true nature, something like that. And these are really tall orders. So for many people at the beginning, it's actually something that gets in the way rather than may support them in just staying with their experience.
Okay, I have one last question for you. My guest is Jafin Sif, and he is a Buddhist monk. And we're going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience, but you can continue listening by going to progressiveradionetwork.com. Now, my last question for you is, Sometimes I feel people who meditate take it far too seriously, especially with the instructions of the particular type of meditation they're doing. It becomes a black and white, only a right way or a wrong way. But I can't help but feel each of us are unique, and some people are more mental, and others are more sensate or tactile, emotional in their orientation, in the way they experience the world and receive insight and wisdom from their experiences. Therefore, shouldn't meditation also have a kind of playful aspect to it, and an attitude that invites experimentation and adventure, just like sexual contact or intellectual discourse or creative processes? I don't believe that we bring enough of that ability to experiment and joy with a positive attitude into what we do on a daily basis, even juicing or cooking.
Yes, I think that's quite true. Truly, meditation is something that will be highly individual, because each person going into his or her mind in their own way and have their own history and temperament and talents and interests. And so to really see that that's going to be part of your meditation experience. And many people who are thinkers often get discouraged from meditating because they feel they shouldn't have thoughts while meditating. And I really believe that thinking is an important part of our experience, our inner world. It occupies a good deal of our time, and that there's a great deal to learn from being with our thoughts and noticing things about our thinking process. And I would say that it's true that when talking about sittings or expressing them, people refer to different aspects. Not everyone's going to talk about the same thing. Some people will talk more about bodily sensations or sounds because that's more what they're naturally aware of. Others may talk more about their internal dialogues. But I wouldn't say that one is superior to the other.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much, Jason Siff, for sharing these insights with us and for the book Unlearning Meditation. And it's unlearningmeditation.com's website. I'm Gary Knoll. In the remaining time before our good friend Mike Fader comes up with the turning point, and that'll be in a few minutes, anyone who wishes to share their comments or thoughts or questions on any issue I've discussed today, please call us at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And we'll wait here a second. I'll see who's calling in, and we'll get you on the air. And in the interim, we have Mike here. Mike, what are you going to talk about today?
Is this working?
Yes, Mike, it
okay.
is.
I think today is going to be a magazine. Usually I try to focus on one subject, but there's so much going on in the news and Alex Rodriguez and gay marriage and everything. I was thinking today I might actually try to do a magazine show. We'll see how that works out.
Meaning Alex Rodriguez is now gay and he's in a magazine.
Yeah, he hit his 600th home run as an illustration to his secret lover. So that was a code to go to the California court. You'll all hear it connected.
We'll hear it today.
Yeah.
That's good. We have Edward from Hawthorne, New Jersey on. Hi, Edward. Edward, you're on the air. Speak up, please. No? Edward's not there.
Hello.
Yes, hi, Edward.
Yes, I've lost part of you when the broadcast went off from the radio, so I missed the sequence. Are you familiar with meditation, or are you familiar with Kriya Yoga?
Yes. Your question, please?
Yes, in meditation, are you familiar with Kriya Yoga?
Yes, and I'm asking you, do you have a question or comment you'd like to share with us?
Can you comment on how beneficial it is?
Well, I believe, yes, I believe that all forms of meditation can benefit the person if they believe that there is benefit to it. Let's go back to what I suggested at the very beginning of the program, and that is when I was reading about a new study that showed that a person's belief and expectation in an outcome directly impact dopamine levels, that in turn creates a sense of optimism, and that optimism can make it work. It'd be no different in people believing that doing yoga in a hot room is going to be more beneficial than in a regular room or in a cold room. Think how many places in the world, in India and Pakistan and China, where they do meditation or do yoga and it's cold. they still benefit from it because they don't allow the external environment to interfere in the process they're trying to achieve. In fact, if anything, they try to use it to support them. So therefore, I see only benefit for any meditative technique, any yoga technique that a person believes in. All right? And that's that. I'm going to give Mike plenty of time. Get ready for his show here. We'll be saying goodbye today. I want to thank all of you. And Mike, by the way, your audience just keeps growing and growing. And you hit another level.
Well, that's really good to hear. I'm really glad to hear that.
I mean, you have virtually doubled again your audience over the last 2 months. So
There must be something I'm doing, and I have to figure out what it is.
Okay, well, that's good.
Okay.
But it's all good.
All right.
Mike Fader coming at you in just a moment. I'm Gary, and I'll have a wonderful day, and thank you all for making Progressive Radio Network the place for thinking people, independent minds, compassion, and sensitivity. Have a good day, everyone.
Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.